I'd like to thank John and Phil and whoever else is involved in making this possible for us to connect electronically and live to the other congregations here in North and Central California. I love technology, except when it comes back to bite you. Like, Mr. Geezy, you thought you were sending me the list, and you didn't. Anyway, Mr. Geezy and I are in the same age group, which means we're dinosaurs, according to my son. Anyway, we're learning and adapting, and we appreciate your patience. Over the past 2 weeks, I have received a couple of personal requests and also some emails asking for me to give a sermon that I have given before. And for those of you who've heard it before, I apologize. But I would like to give a sermon that I think is relevant to us today. I'd like to begin with a question. Where were you on 9/11/2001? Probably everyone in this room and everyone listening to me now remembers. Don't you? 9/11. The date is burned in our memories. I remember where I was because psychologists tell us that we remember things that have an emotional impression on our brains. That's probably why women remember better than men, because they tend to be more emotional than men, and they tend to pack away those emotional moments, and they remember more than us guys do. And most of us who are married, you know, we go to our wives and we say, now, what was that date? You know, when's my anniversary? because those are emotional imprints on our brains. But 9/11 made an emotional imprint on your brain and my brain, didn't it? And we remember where we were, just like those of us who are old enough remember where we were when we heard about the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. I remember that. I see people nodding, and it's too early to sleep, so I think we all understand what I'm talking about. I was in right outside of Baker, Washington on 9/11. I was fly fishing, and I was staying at a little resort in the shadow of Mount Baker in northern Washington. And I remember I came in from fishing. I'd caught a couple of small trout. And I passed a gardener on the grounds of the cabins I was staying at. And he said, have you heard? And I said, heard what? Now, I chose this resort because it had no television, no radio. And I just wanted to get away from it all. It had no Wi-Fi. So, you know, as a minister, you know, you're kind of connected to your smartphone, which I found out is not any smarter than the operator. And I wanted to get away from the computer, the smartphone, and all civilization. So that's where I went for my vacation, fly fishing. And I said, what news? And he said, they just crashed into the World Trade Center, and you know, everything is coming apart in New York, and we don't know what's happening, but the terrorists have struck. And I said, what? Really? And I ran back to the room, and we were sharing it with another couple, and I said, hey, did you guys hear? And they were just waking up. No, what? And I shared the news with them, and you know, we had all this sketchy news. We didn't know what was going on. So we ran outside, and we jumped in the car, and we drove down to the bar, which was about a half a mile away. And for some reason, they were open, probably because of this event. And we went inside, and we were watching the TV in the bar, probably the same thing many of you saw on the news. It was after the second plane had hit the World Trade Center. But we remember that, and we thought, wow, what an event. Terrorists attacking the United States of America. Our lives have all been changed forever because of that event, hasn't it? We're reminded every time we go through an airport, because we have to go through all kinds of security now, don't we? We remember it every time we go into a state or federal building, because you have to go through a metal detector. We're reminded because it affected us. on the day we were hearing about the news, and every day ever since we're reminded of it. If you tune into the news, you've been reminded of it more recently, haven't you? By the events in Iraq and Syria, with the raising up of this army seemingly out of nowhere that calls itself ISIS, or ISIL, standing for the Islamic State in Lebanon, or the Islamic State in Syria, or the Islamic State in Iran now. 15,000 men it started out to be, and it's grown almost exponentially. These are extremists, Islamic extremists, who act in the most inhumane way. And we saw this played out on video, on YouTube, this past week, with the beheading of a journalist, recorded for effect for all of us to see. Thankfully, the major networks that I tune into for news occasionally didn't show it, which I was greatly appreciative of. But have you ever thought, what makes somebody want to kill men, women, and children in an airplane catastrophe? What is it that inspires somebody to chop somebody else's head off with seemingly no more feeling than opening a can of beer? What is it that allows somebody to devalue life to that level? What is it that goes on in the brains of someone like that? Have you ever wondered that? How did it happen? You know, it says that God destroyed the pre-flood world because of violence. And we know clearly what had happened. The value of life had dropped to such a level that people didn't count life to be worth much. It makes you wonder, what is the origin of the conflict behind terrorism and the events of 9/11, and what continues to go on today? When did all this begin? That's what I'd like to talk about in my sermon today. If you want to title it, how about Terrorism in Prophecy? Because there are a number of prophecies we're going to go through today that talk about the events that we're experiencing today were prophesied. Let's begin in Genesis, which means beginning. So we're going to begin here with the story of what I believe the source of a lot of this thinking that we sometimes can't understand that takes place in the minds of some men and women who've now joined the ranks of suicide bombers. How can this take place? Something has to happen in the brain for this to begin to happen. And I think we know now that there is an origin to these kinds of things, and there's also copycats. People find that it brings a lot of attention through the news media, so they want to try terrorist activities themselves. But let's go here to Genesis chapter 25 and verse 20. I'd like to begin here. This is the story of Isaac and his wife, Rebekah. It says in Genesis 25 verse 20, Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah as his wife, the daughter of Bethuel, the Syrian, of Padan Aram, the sister of Laban the Syrian. So all of these things that we're reading about in the news are taking place in roughly the same geographical location as these events. It says in verse 21, Isaac pleaded with the Lord for his wife because she was barren. And the Lord granted his plea, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. Now, if you just read over the scripture, as Mr. Braswell told us, without reading the context, you think, oh, she couldn't have a baby, so he prayed that she would conceive. And, well, God answered the prayer right away, and she conceived. Well, if you read a little further, you'll find out that Isaac was 60 years old when the boys were born. So it took 20 years for that prayer to be answered, which is kind of, an interesting passing thought, because I've visited with people before, and they say, Mr. Register, you know, we've been married for 6 months, and we can't get pregnant, you know. Can you pray for us? Well, of course I'll pray for you. And they say, yeah, right, we don't understand it. You know, why hasn't God blessed us with children yet? And I said, well, sometimes these things take time. And I usually cite the example of Isaac and Rebekah. 20 years he prayed for his wife to conceive. And she finally conceived, says in verse 21. In verse 22, but the children struggled together within her. She had twins. She was pregnant with twins. And she said, if all is well, why am I like this? Now, those of us who've been married, you know, we go through this experience if we've had children. And, you know, your wife says, feel it. It's turning over. And you feel your wife's stomach and you feel the movement that's taking place in there. Well, apparently there was a battle going on in her womb. And as the fetuses grew in her womb, there's this like this wrestling match going on. And, you know, those of you who've been mothers, you know what they're kind of, that's uncomfortable and pushes organs around as the baby gets larger within the womb and begins to move around and kick. It wakes you up sometimes at night, right? Well, this was a battle that was going on inside of her. And so it says she went to inquire of the Lord. And I think this is more than just prayer. It's my belief that we read here in the book of Genesis that the patriarchs and their wives had the opportunity to actually go to Melchizedek. Remember? The priest in Salem? And inquire of him, talk to him face to face. We know Abraham's experience. And it says, so she went at the end of verse 22 to inquire of the Lord. And the Lord said to her, and we know this is God in the form of either Melchizedek or at the very least an angel. Again, it's not spelled out, but it is an interesting question to ask and to muse about. The Lord said to her, two nations are in your womb. Two people shall be separated from your body. One people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger. Now, I don't know about any of you. I've got two sons, and if somebody came to me and said, your two boys will become nations. Now think about that for a minute. Your two boys are going to multiply and become nations. That means thousands of people will come from your loins from these two people. Wow. That didn't quite explain the war that was going on in her belly. But it explained that there was a little competition going on. And she experienced that right until they were born. In verse 24, so when her days were fulfilled for her to give birth, indeed there were twins in her womb. And the first came out red, and he was like a hairy garment all over, so they called his name Hairy. Which makes sense, Esau. And afterward his brother came out, and his hand took hold of Esau's heel, so his name was called Jacob. In English, we say Jacob, which means supplanter, or the one who wants to take the place of. And the birthright was very important during the patriarchal period. It came with a blessing. It came with the birthright. It came with the inheritance of most of what the patriarch owned. It was an important position to be in, the firstborn. Esau was born first. Jacob, who wanted to be born first, that kind of explained the war that was going on, grabbed hold of his brother's heel, and one popped out, two popped out, and he had a hold of his brother's foot. And so they named children in these days characteristic of not just parentage or a favorite name, a name book, but they named them according to some of the characteristics they had. In fact, one book I read said that in the Jewish tradition, they normally didn't name a child until he was 3 or 4 years of age because they wanted to see the characteristics of the child. I don't know what they called him, hey you, or whatever, until he got to be 3 or 4. But in this case, they named them right away because they began to see their natures right away and their characteristics, Esau and Jacob. And the prophecy was that there would be a continual struggle for who's going to dominate here. Normally the firstborn would dominate, but the Lord said in the prophecy in verse 23 that the younger would dominate over the older. The troubles between these two began early in the womb, and they continued on. And we could go through verses 27 through 34, which describes, of course, the birthright being sold for a bowl of porridge, or red soup, I guess it was. Again, you know the story. I'm not going to go through it. Probably learned this in Sabbath school or in your parents' home long time ago. You know the story. There was always this conflict, and Esau didn't really value his birthright at the time. He was very hungry, so he traded it for a morsel of food, if you will. But let's go to chapter 27, verse 34. We're going to fast forward now to the point of the blessing where the patriarch blesses, Isaac now blesses his two sons. And you know the chicanery and the deception that took place on behalf of the supplanter, the guy who wanted the blessing, the guy who wanted to replace the firstborn, a very competitive fellow by the name of Jacob. And that's probably another sermon. But I'd like to drop down to verse 34. Chapter 27, verse 34. And when Esau heard the words of his father, that is the blessing that he laid upon Jacob, the secondborn, he cried with an exceedingly great and bitter cry and said to his father, bless me, me also, O my father. But he said, your brother came with deceit and has taken away your blessing. And Esau said, is he not rightly named Jacob, the supplanter? For he has supplanted me these two times. Number one was through purchasing the birthright for a bowl of soup. And number two was when he deceived his father for the birthright blessing. He took away my birthright, and now look, he has taken away my blessing. And he said, have you not reserved a blessing for me? And Isaac answered and said to Esau, indeed, I have made him your master, just as the prophet prophesied. And all his brethren I have given to him as servants. With grain and wine I have sustained him. What shall I do now for you, my son? And Esau said to his father, have you only one blessing, my father? Bless me also, my father. And Esau lifted up his voice and wept. And Isaac, his father, answered and said to him, behold, your dwelling shall be of the fatness of the earth, the good things, and of the dew of heaven from above. But notice verse 40. By your sword you shall live, and you shall serve your brother. And it shall come to pass when you become restless that you shall break his yoke from your neck. And verse 41. And so Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing with which his father blessed him. And Esau said in his heart, the days of my mourning for my father are at hand. Then I will kill my brother Jacob. The competition got so great, it was premeditated murder was planned here. Again, I'm not going to go through the rest of the story, but you know eventually Jacob had to leave and escape. Never saw his mother again, who was his favorite. Never saw his dad again, who died. I mean, Jacob paid the price. Even though he's considered one of the patriarchs and the father of Israel, a righteous man, he paid the price for his attitude of competition with his brother. Again, that's maybe fodder for another sermon. These two men had this tension between them. Now, they finally met at one point, and Esau had grown a little soft towards his brother and forgave him to a certain extent, but the prophecy was that there would always be this competition and the younger would be master over the older. Now let's fast forward and go to Genesis 36. Genesis 36. In verse 8, we come to the descendants of Esau. Remember, these two boys were to grow into a nation. So now we're looking down the road several decades, and they have been multiplying and rapidly having children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. And we find here in chapter 36 in verse 8, and so Esau dwelt in Mount Seir. Esau is Edom. Now, we know that Moses put together the first five books of the Bible, the Pentateuch. So he's writing in his context backwards this history. And he's looking at what Esau became. Esau became a nation that was called Edom, the Edomites, the land of Edom, which today is located in southern Jordan. Mount Seir is the mountain range that has a pretty famous valley in it called Petra. Now, what is really interesting is from this mountain range, from the top of these mountains, which I have had the blessing of hiking, you can get to the top of them and you can look to the west and you can see Israel. You can see the Promised Land. You can see the Dead Sea. You can see the Jordan River Valley. And across to the west, you can see the land of Israel. And in fact, if you jump ahead and you look at some of the prophecies regarding Edom in the book of Jeremiah, about chapter 30, 35, you'll find that when the Assyrians attacked Israel, that the Edomites, that is the descendants of Esau, were observing from this mountaintop, and they could see the smoke, they could see the fires, they could see the commotion of war, and it says that you laughed. You laughed at your brother's calamity. Talking about Jacob's calamity, when they were taken captive by the Assyrians. And God said through the prophet Jeremiah, your time is coming. And Edom fell, as we know, and they lost Mount Seir, that land today that, like I said, is pretty famous. It belongs to the land of Jordan right now. What is really kind of interesting that I'll tell you as a sidebar, a couple of years ago, I think it was 2010, we attended the feast in Jordan. And at that point, Jordan was a city of about 2.5 million people. Amman, city of 2.5 million. And when we were there, there was some discussion about a water crisis that was coming. And they said the 2.5 million people is going to run out of water in about 20 years. Sound familiar? Those of us who live in California. But anyway, and the question was, what are these people going to do? You're going to run out of water in 20 years from the aquifers and the natural rivers that flowed through that part of Jordan. What are you going to do? And what is really interesting is that geologists discovered a deposit of natural artesian water under a place called Wadi Rum, which is just south of Mount Seir. And when we were there for the feast, we were driving down what they call the Jordan Highway, or the King's Highway, that goes on the east side of the Jordan. And alongside the highway were these big 24-inch pipes all along the highway. And we asked the driver, what is that going to do? What's that for? And he said, they're making a water pipeline from Wadi Rum all the way up to Amman. And they're bringing all that artesian water up to the city. And it's going to save the city of Amman, which is kind of interesting. What's one of the most valuable commodities in the Middle East? Water, right? Next to oil, water in the Middle East. So Esau dwelt in Mount Seir, it says in verse 8. Esau is Edom. And this is the genealogy of Esau, the father of the Edomites in Mount Seir. And a lot of times we just read through these lists, you know, you can get pretty bored. I mean, if you want to, this is better than a sleeping pill at night, is to open the Bible and read, you know, genealogies. You know, go to Genesis 10, read the genealogy of the sons of Noah. After about 10 minutes, you know, you're conked out. But there's some things that you find that are really interesting. Verse 10, these were the names of Esau's sons: Eliphaz, son of Ada; Reuel, son of Basemath; and the sons of Eliphaz were, but I like to focus on verse 12. I don't want anybody falling asleep as we go through the genealogies. Verse 12, now Timnah was the concubine of Eliphaz, Esau's son, and she bore Amalek to Eliphaz. Now remember the prophecies we've read, and remember this name Amalek, because it's going to come up again in the history of Israel. Remember, there's going to be competition between the descendants of these two brothers. There's going to be trouble. There's going to be challenges that will come up. and we find Amalek here. Now, if we follow, you know, it's like pulling a thread out of a ball. Now, let's pull this thread of Amalek out of this ball of twine. And let's go forward about 270 years. Now, remember, these sons are both going to grow into nations. What has happened in 270 years from the time we just read until we get to 270 years later, the time of Israel? Israel has grown into a nation in captivity in Egypt, remember? They're now coming out of Egypt. They're millions of people now. The prophecy's fulfilled. Think of 270 years. When was 1776? How many years ago? Less than 270 years. When this country was founded. How many people do we have in the U.S. today? 350, 60 million, right? Something like that. You see how fast a family or a nation or a group of people can grow in less than 250 years? As an illustration. So let's go to Exodus chapter 17. We come to a time the Israelites have come out of Egypt. There's now millions of the son of Jacob, right? And they encounter a people we read about in Exodus 17, verse 8. It says, "Now Amalek," remember who he is? The grandson of Esau. "Now grown into a nation of people. Now Amalek came and fought with Israel in Rephidim," which is in the southern part of what we would describe today as maybe the Sinai Peninsula. "Amalek came and fought with Israel in Rephidim. They are the first nation of the Canaanites to attack the Israelites. And Moses said to Joshua, 'Choose us some men and go out and fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I'll stand on top of the hill with the rod of God in my hand.' So Joshua did as Moses said to him and fought with Amalek. And Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up on the top of the mountain." You know the story. They went up there, and as long as they held the staff of God high in the air, they prevailed. And when his arm got tired, what happened? Well, the Amalekites prevailed. And it says in verse 13, "But in the end Joshua defeated Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword." Now, we're going to find out very soon that all of Amalek didn't die. And normally when you defeated an army, you defeated the men of valor, the men of war. And the spoils of war were usually the women and children and their houses and their vineyards and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But we find that these Amalekites are more nomad than gardener, if you will, or ranchers. But Joshua defeated the Amalekites. Verse 14, "And the Lord said to Moses, 'Write this for a memorial in the book and recount it in the hearing of Joshua, and I will utterly blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven.'" Here's a prophecy. God says, "I'm going to destroy the memory of Amalek from under heaven." Now, why would God say that? Well, hold your finger here and let's go over to Deuteronomy chapter 25. Deuteronomy 25 and verse 17. Deuteronomy 25 verse 17. This is near the end of Moses' life. And he's recounting some of the history of Israel. And we get towards the end of this accounting of history. Deuteronomy 25 verse 17. "Remember what Amalek did to you on the way as you were coming out of Egypt. How he met you on the way and attacked your rear flanks. All the stragglers at your rear when you were tired and weary and he did not fear God." He's describing here the way these people fought. Normally, when you fight a battle, you have the men of valor face off with the men of valor, the archers, the chariots, and you fight face-to-face, man-to-man, right? These people were guerrilla warriors. What they did is they hid in the rocks, and as the Israelites passed through the canyons, they came around and attacked the rear. Who was in the rear? Women, children, old men. They were dirty fighters, in other words. That's what we say today. They attacked the defenseless. They didn't attack the people with weapons. They attacked the rear flanks. Therefore it shall be, verse 19, when the Lord your God has given you rest from the enemies all around in the land which the Lord your God is giving you to possess as an inheritance, that you will blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. You shall not forget. He said, when you settle into the land, this is what you're going to do with the descendants of Amalek. Because they're dirty fighters, they're bloodthirsty, the value of life has no value in their eyes. I want you to wipe them out. I'm going to tell you something. In 1988, I had the privilege to go to Israel for the first time. My wife and I traveled over there with the Ambassador College students. And at that time, we had a very interesting bus driver. He was in his 60s. But I don't know if you know anything about the Israeli Defense Force, but everyone, men, women, everybody serves in the Israeli Defense Force. I believe 3 years is mandatory service. And then when you get out of the service, you're in the reserves. Everybody's in the reserves, and you're in the reserves until you retire at 65 or 70. You're in the reserves. So I observed that this bus driver we had, he had an Uzi under the bus seat. Well, it makes you feel kind of comfortable on one side, and on the other side you wonder, wow, why does he carry that? And one thing we did on the bus, we had a few extra seats on the bus. Our tour group didn't fill every seat on the bus. Whenever we would see an Israeli soldier hitchhiking, we would pick him up. Bus driver would pull over, pick him up, and we'd carry these Israeli soldiers, you know, to the wherever they wanted to go, as long as it was on our route. And I remember they would exchange something in Yiddish as they got on and off the bus. And, you know, of course, I didn't know Yiddish. And I asked the bus driver after a couple of days and after picking up a few soldiers along the way, I said, what are you saying? And he was thinking about it, trying to conjure up what they were saying to each other. And he said, the phrase in Yiddish is, remember the Amalekite. I said, you got to be kidding me. Remember the Amalekite? I said, that was a long time ago. He said, but God told us not to forget. The Israeli army still remembers to this day this phrase. Deuteronomy 25:19, you shall not forget. So as they battle the enemies around them, it's kind of interesting, the same bus driver told me, he says, Israel has no friends except one. All of our neighbors are enemies. And I said, what friend is that? And he said, the Mediterranean Sea. He says, otherwise, we're surrounded by enemies. He said, we shall never forget. Remember the Amalekite is their battle cry to this day. Okay. Let's go back to Exodus 17. Let's finish this prophecy. In verse 14, God said to Moses, write this for a memorial in the book, Exodus 14, verse 17, and recount it in the hearing of Joshua. In other words, don't forget this, that I will utterly blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. In Deuteronomy 25, we had a reference. He says, when the land is settled. Okay? Let's notice verse 15. And Moses built an altar and called the name, the Lord is my banner, or my flag. For he said, because the Lord has sworn, the Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. The Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. From that time forward, the Israelites were in constant battle with a number of the nations around them, but one consistent enemy was Amalek, the descendant of Esau, that they fought against over and over again. Now, Amalek, because they had this guerrilla warfare nature, they oftentimes would amalgamate and join forces with other nations in the land of Canaan. They would join together and fight against the Israelites. Now, it's really interesting to read commentaries on this section of verse between verses 14 and 16 of Exodus 17. And a couple of commentators agree with what I believe is the subject matter here. In verse 14 says, I'm going to give you a chance to wipe these people out. Because God knew, as we understand God's plan, some people will be better off coming up in a second resurrection in a better world. Won't they? Without their cultural biases, they'll be better off coming up in this new world tomorrow, the kingdom of God. We know that. God knows that. God understood that about these people. So he basically said in verse 14, a time is going to come. I'm going to set up the circumstances that you should wipe these people out because they'll be better off and you'll be better off. Verse 16, but if you don't, they will be a problem to you from generation to generation, all the way to the time of the end. That's what it means from generation to generation, to generation to generation to generation to generation to generation, up until our day today. So the prophecy was, I'll give you an opportunity to take care of this problem. If you don't, they're always going to be a problem. Okay, let's fast forward now. 350 years. God is a very patient man. 20 years before he answers a prayer about conception. 350 years before he gives them an opportunity to take care of the problem. Let's go forward to 1 Samuel chapter 15. 1 Samuel 15 is a very familiar story of the first king of Israel, Saul. The king, the time of the judges has ended. The kings are now beginning. And we find in 1 Samuel chapter 15, verse 2, thus says the Lord of hosts, I will punish Amalek for what he did to Israel, how he ambushed him on the way when he came up from Egypt. Now go and attack Amalek and utterly destroy all that they have. Do not spare them, but kill both man, woman, infant, nursing child, ox, sheep, camel, donkey. Obliterate the culture. I hope we can understand why God may have given that command. As we heard earlier, context is very important, isn't it? The context of this prophecy, this command. Now we know the story, don't we? Saul gathered the men together and they went. And I don't know how or why, I know why, I don't know how God did it, but somehow, I don't know, maybe it was some kind of a special festival, we can only speculate, that he brought together all the people of Amalek. Maybe it was one of their big, you know, special pagan holidays. They all came together. The moment was perfect. God had patiently waited 350 years to this point. He brought it together, the perfect storm. All Saul had to do was do what he was told. And he did, right? No. He decided to spare some of the people. He decided to spare some of the animals for sacrifices. In fact, he spared Agag, the king. Remember? Don't forget that name, Agag. He spared Agag the king. And when Saul heard the bleeding of the, I mean, Samuel heard the bleeding of the animals, he came and said, Saul, what are you doing? And Saul said, I'm doing what God told me. I killed the people. We conquered them. I just brought a few animals here for sacrifice to please God. And I saved the king. You know, it's customary to do that and to show everybody back home that you got the king and to parade him around in front of everybody. And Samuel the priest, Samuel the prophet, Samuel the last judge, he carried a lot of hats too. He said, Saul, what have you done? What have you done? You've disobeyed God. Remember the prophecy in Exodus 17? Wipe them out, or they will be a problem to you from generation to generation. It says in verse 35, and Samuel went no more to see Saul until the day of his death. Nevertheless, Samuel mourned for Saul, and the Lord regretted that he had made Saul king over Israel. God had created this perfect moment, and Saul had failed the test, and because of that, you and I today suffer. Every time you go through the airport, every time you go into a federal building, we're reminded of Saul's failure. Indeed, he did sin. Indeed, he did. Let's go to 2 Samuel chapter 1. 2 Samuel chapter 1 recounts the events immediately following Saul and Jonathan's death. 2 Samuel chapter 1. It says, now it came to pass after the death of Saul, when David had returned from the slaughter of the Amalekites. There they are again. He didn't kill them all. Some got away. They regrouped. And David, 40 years later, has to contend with them. It says, and David stayed 2 days at Ziklag. And on the third day, behold, it happened that a man came from Saul's camp with his clothes torn, dust on his head. And so it was when he came to David that he fell to the ground and prostrated himself. And David said to him, where have you come from? And he said, I have escaped the camp of Israel. And David said to him, well, how did the matter go? Please tell me. And he said, the people have fled from the battle. Many of the people are fallen and dead, and Saul and Jonathan, his son, are dead also. And David said, how do you know they're dead? And the young man that told him said, as I happened by chance to be on Mount Gilboa, there was Saul lying on his spear, and indeed the chariots and horsemen followed hard upon him, and he looked behind, and he saw me, and he said, I'm here. And he said to me, who are you? And he said, I am an Amalekite. That's ironic, isn't it? In verse 9, and he said to me again, please stand over me and kill me. Think about this for a minute. Here's the king, mortally wounded, with a spear halfway through his body, probably broken off at the shaft. And he's pleading for this man. He says, who are you? And he says, I'm an Amalekite. What kind of thought went through Saul's head at that moment? Oh, man, 40 years later, and the fruit of my sin has come back to haunt me. He said, please stand on me. Make sure this spear goes through my body that I can die. And so there's some discrepancy whether or not this man actually did it or whether he was lying, according to the commentators. But can you imagine that somebody would then jump on top of the king so that the spear would continue to go through his body? That's what he claimed took place. And he brought back the crown and the bracelet and the staff. And he said, here it is, hoping that David would give him a position in his government. It is ironic, isn't it? The Amalekites do not fear God, as we were told. So David said to him in verse 16, your blood is on your own head, for your mouth has testified against you when you said, I have killed the Lord's anointed. So David called for his servants to kill this Amalekite. Rather than give him a position in his cabinet, he killed him. Let's fast forward 500 years. 500 years at the time of the Jewish captivity. Let's go to Esther chapter 3. Esther chapter 3 and verse 1. I think basically we know the story of Esther. Esther is a beautiful woman. She's a Jewess. and the king thought she was beautiful and wanted to make her his queen. But the story of Esther is not about the queen, it's about the Jews and their plight. Let's pick up the story in Esther chapter 3, verse 1. And these things King Ahasuerus, after these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite. Recognize that name? Who was Agag? He was the king that Saul spared of the Amalekites, the one that Samuel hacked to pieces. Remember what he said to him? He said, I'm going to hack you to pieces because you have made so many women childless. And again, some commentators say that's not just because he killed men. It's the way in which he killed women. He was brutal and merciless. But somehow he had descendants who had descendants who had descendants who carried on for 500 years to the time that the Jews were in captivity to the Persians. And Haman was promoted within the king's cabinet and advanced him and set his seat above all the princes who were with him. And all the king's servants who were within the gate, king's gate, bowed and paid homage to Haman. He was very high ranking. He had worked his way up very highly in the Persian Empire, one of the great empires of the world. And because of his influence, we know his plans. His plans were to annihilate the Jews. Why? Because he hated the Jews with a deep hatred. He had no value for life. He wanted to kill the Jews, lock, stock, and barrel, man, woman, and child. That was his plan. Remember? Well, we now know that his plan was interrupted and destroyed, thankfully, because of the prayer and fasting of the Jewish people and because of the bravery of the queen, who said, I'm going to go to the king and I'm going to tell him what Haman is really trying to do. If I die, I die. Remember those words? If I perish, I perish. And she went to the king and she told him. In chapter 4, verse 3, and verses 15 and 16, we read, Then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, Go gather all the Jews who are present in Shushan and fast for me, neither eat nor drink for 3 days and nights. My maids and I will likewise fast, and so I will go to the king, which is against the law, and if I perish, I perish. And so because of her bravery and the prayers and the fasting of the Jewish people, they survived. We know what happened finally in chapter 7, verses 3 through 6. We find that she goes to the king and she tells him what has happened, what Haman was trying to do. And in verse 6, Esther says, The adversary and enemy is the wicked Haman. And so Haman was terrified before the king and the queen. And eventually in verse 10, And so they ended up hanging Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. And the king's wrath subsided. His plan was diverted, and he was killed instead of annihilating the Jews. It's an interesting story, isn't it, to follow the history of the Amalekites and how they persecuted the descendants of Jacob. Beginning in Genesis chapter 25, all the way through the history of the Jewish enslavement. Let's notice a couple of prophecies before we conclude this thought. Let's go to Psalms 83. Psalms 83. This particular psalm talks about the enemies of David. Although it's not a song or a psalm of David, it's credited to Asaph, which was one of the chief composers who understood some of what was prophesied for Israel. In Psalms 83, in verse 2, the psalm goes, "For behold, your enemies make a tumult, and those who hate you have lifted up their head. They have taken crafty counsel against your people and consulted together against your sheltered ones. They have said, 'Come and let us cut them off from being a nation.'" Sound familiar? Who has said today, "Our objective is to make sure that Israel is destroyed as a nation"? It's part of the charter of Hamas. It's part of the charter of ISIL and ISIS. What have they said about the United States of America? Same thing, right? "We're going to bring this war to Washington, to your steps," they say. They have said, "Come," verse 4, "let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel may be remembered no more. For they have consulted together with one consent. They form a confederacy against you." And now, of course, a number of people who are probably not descendants of Amalek. It's interesting, after the time of David, the Amalekites were absorbed by the Canaanite nations around them. I gave this sermon once and somebody came up to me and said, "Well, why don't we find these people, do what Saul was supposed to do?" Well, that's not the way we work. Plus, they have been absorbed by all the nations of the world, if you will. As they have been absorbed by all the nations of the world, like I said, there's a lot of copycats. There's also a lot of Westerners now that have joined ranks, you know, from the United States and Britain. In fact, if you can correctly read that video, it sounds like a British guy whose accent comes from southeastern London was the one who actually assassinated that journalist Foley, an American journalist, and cut off his head. So they have formed a confederacy and consulted together with one consent. As it says in verse 5, they form a confederacy against you, the tents of Edom and the Ishmaelites. Now, again, not all the sons of Esau, who was Edom and is today modern Edom, or parts of Jordan and Turkey, and other descendants of Esau, not just the Amalekites. The Ishmaelites are these nomadic tribes that have been formed into nations like Saudi Arabia, which is a collection of nomadic tribes. The Hashemites, forming the kingdom of Jordan, are part of those Ishmaelites. Moab and the Hagarites, Gabal, Ammon, and Amalek. So the descendants of a lot of these nations that Israel was to wipe out joined in a confederacy against the descendants of Jacob. Israel. Who are the enemies of the terrorists? Who are they? Primarily the United States and Britain and Israel, right? This prophecy accounts that at the time of the end, they will join together in a confederacy. I wonder, and I'm wondering out loud, if we can put together the prophecies of the King of the South and equate them with maybe what is beginning to happen among ISIL and ISIS. It says eventually that they push at the King of the North and he comes down with a whirlwind and destroys them at the time of the end. But I'm getting ahead of my story. Let's go to Jeremiah 15, another prophecy. Jeremiah chapter 15 and verse 5. Because I think it brings a natural question to all of our minds: what about us? You know, should I fly? Should I visit the Middle East? Should I go into a federal building? it appears that Amalek is here to stay. His descendants are here to stay. There's going to be problems. They're not going to get any better. They're going to get worse, according to the prophecy. Let's go here, Jeremiah 15, verse 5. Read this prophecy. For who will have pity on you, O Jerusalem? And oftentimes Jerusalem is not just meaning the city of Jerusalem, but Jerusalem represented all of Israel. Who will have pity on you, Israel? Who will bemoan you? Who will turn aside to ask, how are you doing? You have forsaken me, says the Lord. You have gone backward. Therefore, I will stretch out my hand against you and destroy you. And we know that in the future, the time of Israel is coming. And one of the instruments that will be involved in the conquering of modern-day Israel nations will be these Amalekites. I am weary of your relenting, and I will winnow them with a winnowing fan in the gates of the land. I will bereave them of children. Who do the terrorists want to be the victims of their violence? Children. Parents of people fleeing ISIS killed their own children because they were afraid they might fall into the hands of ISIS and ISIL and be raped or be sold as sex slaves. It's a reality of the world in which we live, sadly. I will bereave them of children, in verse 7. I will destroy my people, since they do not return from their ways. Their widows will be increased to me more than the sand of the sea. Talking about soldiers who will die at their hands. I will bring against them, against the mother of the young men, a plunderer at noonday, unexpected times. I will cause anguish and terror to fall upon them suddenly. Terrorism will not end, it will only increase. It's the prophecy. It's in prophecy. It was prophesied. Terrorism in prophecy. Let's go to verse 19. Because this goes back to a very familiar exhortation for God's people. Therefore, says the Lord, verse 19, Jeremiah 15, if you return, if we return spiritually to God, if we repent, then I will bring you back. I will bring you back to me. You shall stand before me. If you take out the precious from the vile, we learn not to mix the clean with the unclean, the vile with the righteous. If you take out the precious from the vile, you shall be as my mouth. You'll be close to me. Let them return to you, but you must not return to them. And I will make you to this people a fortified bronze wall. God will protect his people. Do you know there were people in God's church in the World Trade Center on 9/11? Thankfully, they all escaped with their lives. I've met a couple of them to hear their stories. I will make you to this people a fortified bronze wall. And I will make you to this people a fortified bronze wall, and they will fight against you, but they shall not prevail against you. For I am with you to save you and deliver you, says the Lord. There are a number of stories I've heard of people who've narrowly escaped terrorism. Remember that bomb that went off in that hotel, the Marriott in Indonesia? There was a member there who had a lunch appointment. And just before she went into lunch into that hotel, she got a call and the person said, I'm sorry, I have to cancel. And she left the hotel. And the explosion occurred like 15 minutes later in that restaurant. I remember hearing a story about a member in South Africa who was waiting at his usual bus stop. and a terrorist had placed a bomb, unbeknownst to him, in the building right next to the bus stop. And as he was standing there at the bus stop, he couldn't sit down because there were others sitting in the bus stop bench. He said, "I think I'll go down there." Uncustomarily, he walked a block down the street, stood next to that bus stop, and the explosion occurred, and glass flew out on the people who were waiting for the bus, and a couple of them were killed, and many were wounded. He escaped. It's probably stories we haven't heard about. "For I am with you to save you and deliver you, says the Lord. I will deliver you from the hand of the wicked, and I will redeem you from the grip of the terrorist," or the terrible. But as he says in verse 19, we got to make sure we're right with God. We got to make sure we separate the righteous from the vile, not compromise. We've got to make sure we're close to God. And that's what Christ said in Luke chapter 21. Lest I'm accused of only preaching from the Old Testament, let's go to Luke chapter 21, verse 36, and read the words of Christ. Christ said, "Watch therefore." He wants us to be alert, to be spiritually alert and aware. "Watch therefore and pray always that you may be counted worthy to escape all these things." Get spiritually right with God and then pray for God's protection upon his people, upon us, if we have to go to these dangerous places. As I said earlier in my announcements, to pray for these four young adults in Jordan who are very close to these things. But I can tell you, terrorist attacks in the United States are not going to get any less, because it's prophecy. They're going to increase. Terror attacks in all the nations of modern Israel will occur. It's part of prophecy. We read some of those prophecies. It's going to happen. "Watch therefore and pray always that you may be counted worthy to escape all these things that will come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man." Christ is asking us to watch and pray that we may escape. What is amazing to me in all this study about the Amalekites is that God is true to his promises, isn't he? He's very patient. He's also true to his people. He's very loving and merciful and kind. And he will be true to us, his people, as long as we watch and pray and develop a close relationship with God so that we may escape these things that will surely come to pass.